Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week's edition of the Soapbox will be speaking to activist Mickey Z about the so-called uprising that's happening right now in Hong Kong. Mickey Z is returning to the Soapbox, and he is the author of 12 books, most recently Occupy This Book, Mickey Z on Activism, for which I wrote the foreword. And Mickey can also be found now at the Soapbox People's Network, as he is our newest featured author. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Mickey Z. Mickey Z, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, again, thank you for doing this at the last minute. And the last time I had you on, we were talking about your new book, Occupy This Book, which I wrote a foreword for. How is that book doing?
It's doing great. I've been doing some talks related to it, and basically, it's been a great experience. Really, I hope folks will still consider checking it out. Occupy This Book. Available on Amazon, in ebook, on Kobo, and easy to find. Just look me up on the web, and you'll see connections to it.
Great. Well, I'm glad to give people the opportunity to remind them about it and go ahead and check it out. Well, today we're talking about the quote unquote revolution in Hong Kong. So, if we divided this country down one political line, you know, this chasm, political chasm, it seems like people on our side of this great political divide, they almost always look at a large group of demonstrators and cry revolution. Today, we're going to specifically talk about Occupy Central in Hong Kong. And Mickey, if there are any nations in the world which, you know, have the potential for being a stumbling block to U.S., you know, total U.S. global hegemony, they're China and Russia. And so we saw the maiden movement in the Ukraine, where, again, many people on our side were saying, oh, revolution, we got to get rid of that evil dictator in Kiev, blah, 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 whatever. And so right now we see that there are neo-Nazi fascists in power in Kiev who are committing great atrocities. Of course, that was designed to destabilize Russia. And Russia, of course, is one of those countries that has the potential to be a stumbling block. Mickey, do you remember when Putin stepped in the Syria debate and stopped the U.S. from becoming militarily involved in Syria? And then we have this Maidan movement in the Ukraine, and now the U.S. is militarily involved in Syria.
What a coincidence.
Yeah, isn't that a coincidence?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of pattern recognition. You know, it's a big part of being an activist is understanding history and discerning patterns. And you just laid out one very well right there. And whenever a so-called revolution pops up against an official U.S. enemy, mm-hmm. I think it's a logical perspective to be skeptical. And I guess I want to clarify up front that, of course, I'm not saying I'm not disparaging all the protesters on the street in Hong Kong.
Right.
Not that they don't have legitimate grievances, and that many of them are sincerely protesting. But when the official U.S. Allies have resistance and opposition against them, let's say in Gaza, or go back a little further, the African National Congress, and, you know, prior to Mandela being released. I mean, the U.S. doesn't support people in the street against their allies. So the alarm should go off when the White House is publicly supporting something called Occupy Central.
Right.
I don't think it's cynicism. I think it's a healthy skepticism to say if this is on the cover of Time being called the Umbrella Revolution, and the White House press secretary is praising it, coincidentally at a time that the U.S. begins launching drones and cruise missiles into yet another country, and right here on the streets of the U.S., they're militarization and tear gas is prevalent. So now we get to focus on communist tear gas instead of the tear gas in Ferguson, because it seems like a little healthy skepticism is the least that we could ask. And a little deeper digging shows that there's straight up connections between this uprising and the State Department and the National Endowment of Democracy and so on. So I think that I'm glad that you're discussing this, and I wrote an article on worldnewstrust.com in which I just gathered some of this information. I'm not going to claim any unique research sources. It's you have a search engine. You type in State Department and Hong Kong, and I mean, it's not hard to find. And then you present this information, and you say, here's some context. So before we rush to support everything as an equal form of activism, it can't hurt, it can never hurt to gain a sense of perspective and context.
Well, Mickey, can I just make an observation that communist tear gas is way different from the freedom spray that the U.S. deploys here in the United States?
I appreciate the clarification. that was a terrible slip up on my part. Did you call it freedom spray?
Yes, freedom spray.
Oh, I love it. Okay, yeah.
It's not
silly
gas.
Me. Okay,
it's
that has a little spray. Trademark PM at the end of it, I'm sure, right? So, okay.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, there is communist tear gas and there's freedom spray, so I guess I understand why Time magazine puts one on the cover and not the other. But,
well, let's talk about the National Endowment for Democracy and the National Democracy Institute for a second. If there was any organization in the U.S. that was more Orwellian named, it has to be these institutes, I guess. The National Endowment for Democracy was started under the Reagan administration when the CIA ties to the, was it the scandal of the CIA supplying arms to the counter-revolutionaries in Latin America?
In Central America, yeah.
Yeah, Central America. And then they decided that they weren't going to overtly do that anymore, except we know that they do that still. And so the National Endowment for Democracy was created because it seems like who would be opposed to endowments and democracy? They sound so, benign and wonderful.
Yeah, it Orwellian would be a wonderful way to phrase that. It's the people in power learn the lessons far more profoundly than those out on the streets doing the struggling. They recognize what works and what doesn't work. I recently wrote an article about the history of U.S. public relations dating all the way back to Edward Bernays, nephew of Sigmund Freud. We get called conspiracy theorists when we discuss like this, but it's a very, very Machiavellian agenda where they say, how do we manipulate people to respond to certain words so that we can then use those words to mask our needs and what our mission? And National Endowment for Democracy, in a country like the United States, as heavily conditioned as we are here, sounds like a wonderful name. But without much digging at all, it's subsidiary, the National Democratic Institute, equally as silly a name. I found just quotes that they had a series of missions to Hong Kong to consider the development of Hong Kong's election framework. And this began as far back as 1997 when Hong Kong was handed over from British rule to Chinese rule, and they began to look for young political leaders, these are their words, and women's political participation, and in particular this movement leader, Martin Lee, is someone that has his own page on the National Endowment for Democracy website. Like, he has his own page, and he's one of the leaders there. So I don't think it's counterproductive to aim a skeptical eye and dig a little deeper there. And I think it would be also a form of solidarity to say that the people who do have genuine grievances in Hong Kong deserve our support and deserve us exposing how the U.S. is trying to co-opt their grievances for its own agenda. So I've had a fair, it's just in a short time since I wrote this article, and I've had a fair amount of people on the left upset that I don't have this blind support for the Umbrella Revolution. But I think we all play a role in this, and I think it's a healthier perspective to just say, hey, what's going on, and why is the White House press secretary supporting it? I mean, how can anyone that's been following activism for even more than a couple of years not get suspicious when White House spokesperson is in support of something called Occupy Central?
I certainly don't understand it. And, you know, like, I framed this as the people on our side of that political divide want to jump on the revolution bandwagon. I think, first of all, if you want to just focus it to us here in the United States, first of all, we're looking for any tipping point that's going to undermine and collapse the empire, for sure. And so maybe that's why some of us want to tend to latch on to that. But Mickey, if you look at what's happening, what's been happening under Obama, do you think that the same people who are upset with you for pointing out these facts would be upset with you if it were Romney or McCain who were doing their White House and State Department who were doing these kinds of things?
You basically just read my mind. Exactly. It's when you began the discussion with the setting up that divide, I was thinking about the folks who were on our side and how every 4 years they fall into the lesser evilism, and how anytime people hit the streets, you know, they're ready to leap behind it. As if, like, people in the streets is automatically a radical thing. We had over 100,000 people in the streets here in New York for a permitted climate parade. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't necessarily translate into tangible results, but you're right. We have these cartoon-like Republican characters that people on the left enjoy attacking, and they sort of at the least tolerate the Democrats, at the most worship the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And what happens to folks like you and I who say, well, you know, a war crime is a war crime regardless of who commits it, and it shatters their illusions of democracy and of a system that might be working. And we're saying exactly what you said. We need to completely dismantle empire. It's not a matter of choosing which figurehead is slightly more palatable, if they even are more palatable. So I would definitely agree with you. The people who were getting frustrated for me not supporting the Umbrella Revolution, or the ones who got angry when I said, what is this climate, you know, parade about, are the same ones who would gleefully be attacking Romney or Bush or any other Republican under the same exact circumstances and be loving what I was saying. So it's unfortunate. That's a divide that puzzles me to no end. I'm already thinking that we're about 2 years now away from the next election, so it's just about time now for the lesser evilism to really start kicking in. And you keep hoping every 4 years that people on the left won't fall for the same stuff, but in my lifetime, I haven't seen it. And so I think this is a fine example of that. It comes back to what I said about pattern recognition. If you do your homework and you pay attention with even an iota of objectivity, you can recognize these patterns. And it's quite liberating then, in my opinion, to then recognize that the way the elites operate are somewhat predictable, and then that would make it slightly easier to create opposition to that because the patterns are predictable. But if we are willing pawns within these patterns, then we offer no opposition at all. We're just part of the charade that, you know, we take to the streets and we present the illusion that look how we do it in America. It is a free society and people can take to the streets and this is what democracy looks like, as opposed to us really demanding a voice and really holding all these elected and non-elected officials accountable.
I like my little protest march chant. Whose streets? Our streets. Our streets between 11 and 1 with proper permits.
Yeah, you get accused of being cynical when you say stuff like that, but I've been on my fair share of protests in March, and when they chant whose streets? Our streets, and someone is holding a permit, the right. Barricades are up, and you're surrounded by a militarized force that has the freedom to beat you senseless and in some cases kill you with impunity. You say, really, our streets? No, this is not the case. And so in the article that I wrote, like one of the points I made at the end ties into this in the sense that, well, what can we do when we're up against a system so deeply embedded like this? And besides learning our history and being skeptical, this is what I wrote. We can put in the hard daily work of creating authentic connections within our own community. The intersectionality, solidarity, and trust we build on a local level is the only chance we have to not become an unwitting pawn in the geopolitics of the 1%. And I truly believe that, because if we could create genuine solidarity across lines that typically aren't crossed, We stand the chance of learning from each other and not falling prey to these same patterns over and over. But otherwise, if we're just posting stuff on social media and clever memes and pictures and worried about how many followers we have versus worrying about what results we're getting, we pose no threat at all to the powers that be. And I look at these opportunities, things like the Umbrella Revolution, as wonderful teaching moments. It's not about cynicism. It's about enlightenment. It's about waking up to how the system really works. And then, therefore, once we accept how it really works, we can come up with new tactics and ideas on how to address it, because the old tactics clearly aren't working.
We need to start a new group called Enlightened Cynics. But you know, I spend a lot of time on Facebook. I mean, not I don't have a so-called smartphone, so I'm not on it 24/7 like some people. But you know, I've seen where Facebook has caused a greater divides. It's like if you go 1 degree off of somebody's worldview, then you're useless. You know, so instead of creating solidarity and community, it's creating more, defective social interactions. But, you know, on one hand, I see that I've been to dozens and dozens of communities for all different kinds of things, from my bike ride across the United States to peace work and promoting my books and things like that. And I see on the local level, and I'm really, really fascinated with this direction that our discussion has taken, from, you know, this so-called revolution in Hong Kong to really what real revolution looks like. On the local level, I see people from all demographics uniting for local causes, like, I don't know, water usage, water rights, fighting so-called city hall and things like that, where people can come together and work together and not put up a wall between each other.
Absolutely. And the wall is there because we live in such a hierarchy-based culture. And we have to recognize the differences between us. We can't, you know, by chanting, oh, we're all one, we're downplaying those who on a daily basis don't have the luxury of saying we're all one. But I'm a big believer that if we accept the differences between us without assigning privilege to them, then that's where the true solidarity happens. And we need that sense of community. And as you just pointed out, it primarily happens on a face-to-face basis. You can't discern tone and gesture, and you really can't even work up a whole lot of trust until you at least have a conversation, even over the phone. And I think that social media is a great starting point. It's become, unfortunately, an end in and of itself. And as you said, it people spend so much time in these long debates and flame wars. If I was the CEO of Goldman Sachs, I mean, I would be laughing my ass off. I mean, what threat do we present if we're going to spend 3 hours arguing over minutiae on someone's Facebook page, as opposed to getting out into the community, as you're talking about doing, and interacting with people who typically we don't interact with. I think that we need to have a blend of using this technology to make global connections, but getting off the technology and making those local connections so that we can create trust and solidarity across groups that typically don't have trust and solidarity, and then make it possible to have conversations that when suddenly a spontaneous uprising occurs, that we can have an intelligent conversation about it and say, well, what do you think of this, and what do you think of what's going on behind, as opposed to just posting a couple of memes and saying, I did my part. Uh-huh. You know, it's in the day and age of social media, if I was trying to manipulate the umbrella revolution, I mean, you'd come up with a color and like yellow and a symbol, and the next thing you know, Instagram and Twitter and everything is doing the work for you now. You don't even have to, like, they'll do the work for you because it's so pithy and simple. And we need to have a little bit more, a lot more sophistication in how we see the world. And that comes with learning from each other, which, as you said, comes from actually meeting with each other. So I would agree with you. That's what revolution looks like. Not necessarily these occasional uprisings that get a burst across the media and then disappear as soon as the next story takes over. And we can't be so naive to think that those in power aren't aware of what's going on and aren't going to manipulate it for their interests. They've always done that. They always will. So it's time for us to wise up and connect on a whole other level and create a different form of activism.
Well, absolutely. Especially like you mentioned earlier, when, you know, the empire is so not only powerful with military might and hardware, and not just the might, but the will to use it. And it's not only that, it's just very insidious. It's like that octopus that has its tentacles everywhere. And the best place today that this empire has its tentacles is in social media. Duh.
Yeah. I mean, why wouldn't it? Why wouldn't it? These aren't conspiracy theories. This is the corporate model, basically transported across the entire globe. I mean, where are the consumers? That's where you go, where the consumers are. And then what do you want to do? Manipulate the consumers to your point of view. There's nothing unique or even interesting about that. That's how it's always been. And it was a very conscious effort in the beginning of the public relations industry, which the first big move it did was to get the U.S. People to support the U.S. entering World War I, and then basically hasn't stopped since, almost exactly a century at this point.
Right.
So we could look at it that a century is a blink of an eye in terms of human development, so this is something we can turn around. But it's going to require a lot more will and a lot more willingness to step out of comfort zones than we've seen before, and definitely a lot more self-education and skepticism as to what kind of world we live in. That's not cynicism. It's enlightened cynicism.
Enlightened cynics. Well, you know, that just really gets me. It's like, analyzing things and looking deeper is actually frowned upon in the, here in the United States. Under Bush, I was just amazed at all the right-wingers who would say, oh, we're over in Iraq, your son died for freedom. And I would say, but look at how things are going here in the United States. How can you say, as we're rapidly descending into this police state, that it is about freedom at all, not using critical, you know, they weren't using their critical thinking skills then. And now, today, if you look at everything Obama's done, if you just like scratch the surface, you don't even have to dig very deep, scratch the surface, you can come up with all kinds of facts. And but then you're called a conspiracy theorist and, you know, just accepting things at face value when, you know, there's a Democrat in office now. But and then the right wing, I tell them, why aren't you supporting Obama? He's just like Bush, only worse. So, you know, I said, you should be sending him money. You should be sending, you should be doing.
I can remember saying that when Clinton ended welfare with that bill. I remember saying that would have been Ronald Reagan's deepest dream. But this, it's like the Democrats get in and they do the real dirty work that the Republicans couldn't even get away with, like announcing publicly we're going to end welfare as we know it. And Obama's just taking that to a whole other level. I mean, he's with one hand he's accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, and with the other he's launching drones into multiple countries. And people say, "Oh, thank goodness Romney didn't win."
Right? Exactly.
It's really like, are we going to do this again over the next 2 years? You know, everyone's going to start talking about. They're going to come up with a so-called progressive candidate and at some point agree that he or she can't win, so we got to all gather behind the selected candidate. It's like a script that we've all read and participated in 1,000 times. Like, when are we going to deviate from the script and refuse to be willing players in it? And it's very depressing every 4 years to see an already low level of critical thinking virtually vanish. And I keep screaming into the wilderness about it, and I won't stop. But I'm glad that people like you are out there with big audiences also doing it, because I really do believe that if people can be reached, that they do want to think for themselves, and they do want to be critical thinkers, and they do want to have control of their destinies, and they don't want to be part of a government that's repressing people across the globe and destroying the ecosystem. So I do believe that, and that's what keeps me going, because I do believe this is what people don't want, those things, and we just have to show them a way that perhaps, like a different direction in order to achieve what we want to achieve. Not that we have the answers, but just we know that what we've already tried has failed miserably.
Right. Well, and, you know, just as foreign policy is concerned, you know, we've seen under Obama this domino effect of him going into more and more and more, bombing more and more and more countries in the Middle East, where I think the end game for empire for decades has been Iran. And, you know, Bush was stymied. You know, there was actually a bit of a movement, and he became so, you know, his presidency became so compromised after, you know, Iraq, and, you know, there was actually an anti-war, a significant anti-war uprising. And Katrina, he became so compromised that I don't think they were able to accomplish Iran. But I think Iran, especially hearing Benjamin Netanyahu say how ISIS is being supported by Iran now, I really think that could be Obama's so-called crowning achievement.
Yeah. No, I
without
agree.
Without any significant opposition.
Absolutely. It's the groundwork has been laid, and he's already demonstrated time and time again that virtually anything he does will be rationalized by the so-called left, justified and rationalized. So if his goal before in these last 2 years is to have that as the crowning achievement. I see no reason why he wouldn't try to make that happen and basically achieve the same when you consider from the first Bush into Clinton into Bush the second, and now him, that the same overarching agenda has just been followed. Okay. And because of Obama's demographics, he's able to get away with more. And I mean, I'm not sure where all this can end. Certainly the ever growing destruction of the ecosystem is going to wreak right. havoc on anyone's agenda. Right. And I think that could be the tipping point in terms of how much people are gonna stand for. But you're right. Obama is the dream of the corporate empire's goals. Like that, he's able to do stuff that Bush couldn't dream of.
Well, Bush dreamt of it, but he wasn't. Oh, yeah, he dreamt of it. And we're just like, we just recognize that these people are just figureheads for that corporate empire you were talking about. Well, Mickey Z, I know you have a very busy day, and we really appreciate you coming on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox to talk about these issues. And I'd like to give you an opportunity to, I want to welcome you to the featured authorship of the Soapbox People's Network. So your page will be up there and people can access your articles at the Soapbox People's Network. But I also want to give you an opportunity to, tell people where they can get more information about these things we've been talking about today directly to your page. So, you know, if they feel like the work you're doing is important, they can hit you up with a few bucks or whatever.
I appreciate. Thank you very much, as always, for your support, and I'm really honored to have my work appear on your blog now. And I'm pretty easy to find. You'll find me on Twitter, on WordPress, on Facebook. Facebook, I juggle the hyphen because they wouldn't let me use Mickey Z. So right now it's Mickey Z - Astoria, where I'm born and raised. The blog is at MickeyZ.wordpress.com. My latest book is called Occupy This Book, Mickey Z on Activism, available in print via Amazon and ebook via Kobo, KOBO. And I write regularly for worldnewstrust.com. And pretty much if you type Mickey Z into a search engine, you'll find what I'm doing. And I'm always looking to connect as widely as possible and to learn from people. So I look forward to, I always look forward to reaching out to your audience and hopefully connect with lots of new people. And thank you again, really, for your support and for writing the forward to my book and for having me on the show.
Well, and for beginning our new organization called the Enlightened Cynics.
Yeah, we are the founders of the Enlightened Cynics. So we're going to hold on. We're going to rule it with an iron fist, right?
Right. Okay, Mickey Z, again, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And have a great day and a great weekend. And we hope to talk soon.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, that's our soapbox for this week. I hope you had as much fun listening to it as Mickey and I had recording it. But before we leave, I'm going to list the steps that Mickey talks about in his recent article that's called Obama and Occupy Share an Umbrella, which can be found at the Soapbox People's Network. At the end, Mickey says that we have three steps we need to do when we're confronted with stuff like this. Step one, learn some history. Learn how and why many such uprisings occur. A good place to start your self-education is William Blum's Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II. I highly recommend that book too. Bill Blum's been on our show a couple times. Second step, always aim a skeptical eye at anything you hear from the corporate media, which are as liberal or conservative as the industries that own them. Step three, put in the hard daily work of creating authentic connections within your own community. The intersectionality, solidarity, and trust we build on a local level is the only chance we have to not become an unwitting pawn in the geopolitics of the 1%. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, and my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller. Especially like to thank my guest, Mickey Z, and we look forward to a very fruitful collaboration. And as always, again, I thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.